Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on legislative happenings under the Statehouse Dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host Gavin Jackson, and this episode is for the week of November 5th, 2019. The U.S. House of Representatives voted last week to make its impeachment inquiry formal, and we catch up with the Post and Courier's Jamie Lovegrove, who just returned from a reporting trip in Washington, for the latest. Also, reach out to us on Twitter and Instagram at SCLeadPod, because we want to hear from you. We want to know what you guys think about what's going on, and send us your pictures, send us your questions. And also, special announcement before we even get started here, hit the alarm, not the stick alert. The Lead is back in the upstate, people. I'm not going to tell you the details because you got to listen to Quorum Call to find out those details. Don't skip ahead. Go back to Growler House. More details in Quorum Call. Every Tuesday, we give you a roundup of news, insight into the week's biggest stories, campaign trail intrigue, and a chaser of trivia. Also, make sure you subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, where you can also rate and review us, and wherever podcasts exist, including NPR One. You can listen to all four sections of our podcast while you wonder about parents who drive their kids in between houses to trick-or-treat. You too good for sidewalks? You guys think you're better than me because I trick-or-treat with the sidewalks? Or instead of complaining about daylight saving time. But guess what? We're falling back. This is the easy one, and it's also super comfortable. It's like a good sweater. So just, you know, put the pod on and just fall back with us. Fall back with the Lead. Now for our brief Quorum Call. Quorum Call is a term to see if there's a majority present. But here in the South Carolina Lead, we know a majority of the time that you're not always current with the news. So here's a quick recap of several top stories you should know about. And just like we told you at the top of the podcast, here's some more details about our live Lead taping in Spartanburg on November 14th at 6 p.m. at Growler House in Spartanburg. That's right. We're all going to be there. It's going to be a great time. It's going to be a tremendous time. It's going to be the best time we ever have. So we want to see you out there. Come visit us. Come listen to our taping. We're going to have swag. We're going to have some great guests. We'll have some trivia. It's going to be a fun time. We'll have some pints. It's on November 14th at 6 p.m. at Growler House in Spartanburg. And you guys can RSVP. We're going to have a link in our show notes on scetv.org/sclead. Free to attend. You gotta pay for the beer. But you don't have to RSVP, but let us know if you're coming. We'll get you some name tags. I'll be out there. We'll do selfies. We'll have balloon animals. Can't guarantee about the balloon animals, but we'll have balloon animals. It's going to be great. But we want to see you out there. We know we have plenty of friends up in Spartanburg and in Greenville. So we'll see you soon on November 14th at 6 p.m. at Growler House. Now, leading off at number one, the Post and Courier reports that the State Law Enforcement Division has opened an investigation into the finances of Emanuel AME Church, which received $3.3 million in donations after a racist gunman killed 9 worshipers at its Bible study in 2015. The church kept $1.8 million of that money for the church and divided $1.5 million among the families of the 9 victims, as well as survivor Polly Shepherd. Arthur Hurd, husband of victim Cynthia Hurd, had previously filed a lawsuit looking at the fund Emanuel created to house those donations. However, it did not look at the church's broader finances. Number two, Politico reports that in the next Congress, Senator Lindsey Graham will give his Judiciary Committee chairmanship back to his predecessor, Senator Chuck Grassley, who left to chair the Finance Committee, this at Grassley's request. Senate Republicans allow their members to chair a committee for 6 years in total, which leads to rounds of musical chairs as senators face committee term limits. Number three, the state newspaper reports that a Senate panel heard testimony on a bill that would outlaw using a phone while in a vehicle for almost any reason, even at stop signs and red lights. Drivers would be fined $100 for their first offense and $300 for any repeat stops, and penalized 2 points on their licenses for each offense. The Senate Transportation Subcommittee did not vote on the bill, but it is expected to pass it, possibly with tweaks, before lawmakers return to Columbia for the 2020 legislative session in January. Lead says, don't text and drive, arrive alive. And number four, the state newspaper reports that lawmakers are expected to have another budget surplus this year of around $1 billion. That number is expected to be officially released this Friday, which is on top of the $350 million surplus the state's Comptroller General Richard Ekstrom reported in August. And now for our Florida Man News segment. Every week we give you a headline, a little taste of the most captivating Florida Man news. Headline: Donald Trump is officially a Florida man. And just like the Nats burying the Astros in Game 7 of the World Series, we buried the Lead. The U.S. House of Representatives last week voted to make its impeachment inquiry formal by a vote of 232 to 196, with two Democrats voting with House Republicans against it. The measure passed. Outside of the halls of Congress, 49% of Americans say they want President Donald Trump impeached and removed from office, according to a recent poll from Fox News and a separate NBC News Wall Street Journal poll. That sentiment flips in six key swing states, according to New York Times Upshot poll. But South Carolina Republicans voted against the measure, while its two Democrats voted for it, including Representative Joe Cunningham, the freshman senator in the toss-up 1st Congressional District. The Post encouraged Jamie Lovegrove has been in Washington for the past 2 weeks, unrelated to the Nats World Series run, I assume, and he joins me now in studio to discuss how things are playing out in the nation's capital. Jamie, I see you just put your Nats hat back on. Welcome back. Go Nats. Finish the fight.
I am thrilled to be here. We finished it. I'm fresh off the parade on Saturday.
Yes.
In the middle of downtown D.C. It was just a beautiful sight to behold. An amazing 2 weeks in the history of this great nation.
we want to know, was D.C. traffic just the same gridlock D.C. traffic during the parade?
Yeah, pretty much, but it was a joyous gridlock.
Yeah. There
yes.
you go.
Yeah, it was a very happy kind of gridlock as opposed to the miserable gridlock we're used to.
So was it all just a blur? Do you have any favorite moments, or was it just all one
giant
bubble of emotion?
You know, I mean, I went to games 3 and 5, which were amazing, even though we lost both of them. Of course, we lost all three of our home games.
Yeah.
We won all four of our away games. The first team in the history of Major League Baseball to win four away World Series games. It was amazing. On game 7, I got my spot in Walter's Sports Bar in Navy Yard at 2 p.m.
There you go.
For the 8 p.m. game. Sat there for 6 hours by myself.
Hydrated,
my friends
right?
Came.
I'm sure
very
you're hydrated.
Hydrated. I'm a brand ambassador for White Claws now. And it was just a magical night, which I will never forget.
Awesome, yeah. That and the Caps, I mean, it's...
It's beautiful.
It's a great time.
Titletown, USA.
Titletown, right?
District of Champions.
There you go. Switching gears a little bit from that vibe, Jamie, of victory and success, can we switch to, you know, back to gridlock a little bit here and talk about what was going on? You were up there for 2 weeks, like I said, covering Congress, checking in the delegation. What's the vibe like up there outside of, obviously, the joyousness with the Nats win? What was it like covering Capitol Hill the past few weeks?
Yeah, it's tense. And that's no surprise. And, you know, of course, yeah, part of this sort of juxtaposition of the Nats win was this moment of great unity and excitement for Washington, while on Capitol Hill it is plagued by as much polarization and partisan bickering as ever. You know, that's obviously no real change, but it has continued to intensify as this process has gone on. You know, I've talked to pretty much everyone in the delegation at various points over the last 2 weeks about this process. And if anything, the longer it goes on, the more animated and upset about it the Republicans in the delegation have been. And also the longer it's gone on, of course, House Majority Whip Jim Clyburn has been a leader of this process as a member of Democratic leadership. And he's really laid out the case forcefully. And also, you know, as we'll talk about, Joe Cunningham, the freshman Democrat from Charleston, who was very reluctant to come out in favor of this from the beginning, you know, wary both of you know, the practical element of this and also the political element in a very competitive district down there in Charleston, you know, he has now come around, not necessarily on the broader question. In fact, he'll emphasize that he has not decided on the broader question of impeachment, but he did vote for this resolution last week, setting the ground rules for the inquiry. And so that does reflect something of a shift there.
Yeah, I think we can keep with the Democrats here just because that is really the talking point. Looking at Joe Cunningham in that tight district, I mean, he's been walking this tightrope since he got into Congress, not only on impeachment stuff, but just on major issues itself.
Right.
But he's also seemed to have garnered some, you know, middle ground support in the first district. I even had someone ask me if he was a Republican himself. I'm like, no, I don't think that's the case, but I think he has to just be a moderate Democrat in that area because, I mean, look at it. It was a plus 10 district. I mean, you have these people that are chomping, you have the NRCC just chomping at the bit. What did they say when they said he caved and it will cost him his seat in November when he voted for that. So did Joe Cunningham seem to be like he says he voted for that for the process to become more transparent, which is what everyone wanted in the beginning. The Republicans were complaining about the process of all this.
Yeah.
Now that we're going to have more transparency. But he's still playing it, you know, day by day is what it sounds like. He's not making any you know, judgments ahead of the evidence.
Yeah, he's definitely not going to get out in front of this by any means. And he certainly wants to maintain as much focus as he possibly can on the issues that he does go up there to legislate on, the issues that he campaigned on, the issues that he's on committees for. You know, as as he often points out, you know, he's not on the Intelligence Committee or the Judiciary or House Oversight Committees, which, you know, are playing a role in this process. So he, you know, as he kept saying to me, he knows as much as we do about what has been uncovered so far. He's following the news reports, but he's not inside the room for any of this. You know, part of the reason why he said he wanted to vote for it was because, you know, it will create a process where we can start having public hearings, and then he can actually watch them and start to form a more certain opinion about where this should go. So from the day he got up there, he has tried to focus on those issues that have broad bipartisan support. That makes sense both as a political matter and on a policy front too. You know, the issues that most Charlestonians care the most about, infrastructure, flooding, offshore drilling. Of course, he was the lead sponsor on a bill to ban offshore drilling at the federal level. So he is trying to continue to focus on that, but certainly there is a lot of noise going on all around him. And Speaker Pelosi made this interesting decision to put members like him in this position where they had to take a stand on it last week. They were able to, he and several others were able to kind of stand back during this initial process and kind of say, I'm just going to watch it. And, you know, I support investigations, but not necessarily impeachment inquiry. And there's a lot of quibbling with words because they hold a lot of political meaning. But, you know, ultimately he was put in this position to vote and he did not waste much time deciding. You know, once it was clear that he was going to have to do this, he got the text of the resolution and we spoke shortly after that and he had made up his mind at that point.
And so that's what you're kind of saying. They're trying to correlate this into being like this was the impeachment vote, but that's not the case. This was just to begin formalizing that inquiry. So then, you know, once we see all the evidence, you know, this isn't the big, he didn't just stake his whole, you know, re-election campaign on this vote as people kind of want to make it seem like, you know, no one has at this point. So I guess as the days and weeks go forward, we're going to start seeing, you know, that's really when it's going to be pressure time for Joe Cunningham.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, as you're referencing, immediately after this vote, we have statements from the NRCC, National Republican Congressional Committee, the Congressional Leadership Fund, which is another sort of Republican super PAC or PAC. And, you know, both of them said falsely that he had voted for impeachment or that he'd even voted to remove the president, which the House obviously does not even have the authority to do. And that's obviously a lie. And so we don't print statements that have lies in them. We did see, you know, sort of a more normal form of political spin from South Carolina GOP, for example, which were truthful about what he did. He had voted to move this process forward. And to certainly there are plenty of Republicans out there, a wide majority of Republicans out there who don't even want to do that. So there is no need really to lie to people and say that he had voted to impeach the president. Even by telling them he had voted to move the impeachment inquiry forward, that's going to anger a lot of Republicans. They think that this entire thing is a sham. It should be stopped in its tracks. Obviously, it was pretty remarkable to see every single Republican vote against this resolution. There have been moments over the last few years where we have not seen that level of Republican unity. And we did see sort of in the weeks before this vote, Republicans from various parts of the country raising more concerns about the president's behavior and, you know, expressing some sort of fatigue with having to continue to defend him. But at the end of the day, every single one of them stuck behind him on this vote, and only two Democrats ended up voting against it with them. So it was almost a total party line vote. And that's reflective, you know, as I noted in my story, of the general public right now. You know, the Post and Courier did a poll of change research in South Carolina, and it found that this question is almost perfectly split by party line. 90% of Democrats support moving forward with impeachment, and 92% of Republicans oppose it. So this remains highly partisan right now, and, you know, it's unclear at this point what it's going to take to get that to change in one direction or another.
Yeah, and Jim Clyburn was, Congressman Jim Clyburn, House Whip, was on CNN State of the Union this weekend. He was saying that starting this week and the next week, we're going to start seeing these transcripts come out and start having public hearings so people can make the determination whether this was treasonous, whether there was, you know, all these other situations going on there. And he was asked by Dana Bash about, you know, what kind of negative impact this could have on 2020. He said, sure, it could. You know, they're pretty open with it. But he keeps saying, you know, and he's been saying this for a while, that I believe this whole process to me is about preserving the republic, protecting democracy. But he did say we are in a crisis right now, so it's interesting to hear that. It's also interesting to look at kind of that poll I was referencing about swing states. You know, you look at Florida, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, North Carolina. It's a closer margin there. It's not as overwhelmingly, you know, let's remove him and get him out, impeach and remove. It's kind of the opposite there. So these are going to be things that Democrats have to weigh in, and we're, you know, we'll see that play out on the campaign trail more as these candidates come through. But we can't really say what that's going to mean for people in the congressional district at this point, right, in terms of how this could affect them.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. You know, one note as we talk about polling that I should also bring up is it's yet to be seen, sort of, we haven't seen other versions of this type of numbers, but we, a couple weeks ago, mentioned in a story about the first congressional district Republican primary, First Tuesday Strategies, a consulting firm based in Columbia, did a poll of the first district of the Republican primary. They also asked all those Republican voters that they were polling what their views were on the impeachment inquiry. And actually, 24% of Republicans down there said that they support it. We've known, of course, for a long time that the first district is different from the rest of the state in terms of the Republican makeup. You know, of course, it was represented by Mark Sanford for many years, and he has always marched a little bit to the beat of his own drum and, of course, was not very supportive of Trump. That did in some ways cost him his reelection, but, you know, he still got 49.5% of the vote in that Republican primary against Katie Arrington, who was criticizing him for not being Trump enough. So we know that the Republican Party down there is still divided. Republican voters are still divided over whether to support Trump unequivocally or just support the things that they like. You know, I think that's really the divide. There are, every Republican has elements of the Trump presidency that they like. They like the deregulation. They like the military spending, some of them. They like some of the attempts to cut costs, cut spending, although that has not been very successful. No. They like the tax cuts. But the question of whether to support this kind of conduct, and as more and more evidence just keeps coming out about what exactly the president was doing, we are seeing a little more divergence down there. And so it'll be interesting to watch not just how Joe Cunningham handles this, but also how the Republican primary candidates handle it as well.
Yeah, because you mentioned that, Jamie, in your article, too. Just looking at like some of the Republicans you just mentioned in the state could shift their stance if evidence does, you know, come to light. I mean, we even saw Senator Lindsey Graham come to light on Axios talking about that, too. You know, they all say, you know, the phone call by itself, the Ukraine call by itself isn't enough to be impeachable on their terms. But if there is criminal wrongdoing, they can obviously switch that. And we'll see what evidence comes out about that.
But. Yeah. And Senator Scott has tried to remain very quiet about it. He's basically said, you know, and this is what several Republican senators have said, is I could be a juror in this, so I don't want to talk about it now. I don't want to prejudge the outcome. You know, if the House does impeach and it goes over to the Senate for the trial. I talked in almost all my conversations, all the Republicans, most of them said that they would be open to impeachment if they thought something truly wrong, truly illegal came out. Almost all of them. Joe Wilson actually said he doesn't think there's anything that could come out to change his mind, because he said that the Democrats have been on a quote-unquote witch hunt from day one of the Trump presidency, and so anything that comes out would be tainted. But, you know, most of them say they'd be open to it. It just seems extraordinarily unlikely to me at this point that anything related to Ukraine is going to change some of their minds. You know, one interesting conversation I had last week was with Tom Rice, the Republican from Myrtle Beach. And this is not an argument that has necessarily been picked up by a lot of Republicans. It was sort of similar to the argument Mulvaney made in that press briefing at the White House that he later walked back. But Tom Rice basically said, actually, I think Trump would be wrong if he had not done a quid pro quo, because it's our responsibility to make sure that our military aid that we're sending over there is not going to end up, you know, being used to further corruption. And, you know, if the Bidens are involved in that, then, you know, we have to chase that down. And he basically made the argument that just because Biden's running for president does not mean that he is immune from being investigated. And if anything, that would set a problematic precedent because then you could just run for office to escape investigations. That was a novel argument. That is not something you hear from most Republicans or the White House right now. Mm-hmm. The White House, for now, you know, these messages kind of shift from day to day, but for now is still holding the line of there was no quid pro quo. Mm-hmm. Every now and then you'll see President Trump sort of let out, by the way, if there was quid pro quo, it wouldn't be a problem.
Yeah.
So they're kind of vacillating between those two arguments. But they, for the most part, most Republicans out there are reading from the same playbook right now.
Well, and just kind of wrapping up, Jamie, I want to touch on kind of what you're talking about here when we're talking about mentioning quid pro quo, because we did, you know, hear from Mick Mulvaney, acting chief of staff, about that from the lectern there in the press room. And he's kind of since been had a cool reception from what it seems like from what I was reporting on D.C. saying, I mean, he was even aware of the raid on Baghdadi the other day.
Right.
He was down here in Colombia.
Yeah.
And when bin Laden was getting taken out and these major, you know, missions that the U.S. conducts, like your chief of staff is right there because they're coordinating so many other aspects of this. And for him not to be there, a lot of people read that as he's kind of on thin ice at this point. Did you pick up on anything about what his future might look like?
Certainly there's some grumbling on the Hill about him. Frankly, there have been pretty much the day he got the job. You know, of course, he was a member of the Freedom Caucus. Mm-hmm. So he was not a particularly popular member among the Republican caucus while he was up there. You know, Republican leadership has often battled with the Freedom Caucus over the years, where the Freedom Caucus tries to pull them further right. You know, of course, then he got to the White House and he lost a lot of popularity with the Freedom Caucus because they felt he wasn't pushing Trump far enough
on
the deficit specifically. At this point, it seems like that, you know, the latest reporting I've seen from Maggie Haberman and Jonathan Swan, two of the most plugged in White House reporters out there, is that the sense of folks in the White House is that Mulvaney is safe until the impeachment process is over. You know, obviously the conventional wisdom still in Washington at this point is the House will ultimately vote to impeach and the Senate will acquit. You know, we'll see if that comes to be, but that certainly seems to be where this is all headed towards at some point, you know, and that maybe he would be on the way out after that. He has been a survivor. It should be noted that, you know, he's still referred to as the acting White House chief of staff, but he's been there considerably longer than Trump's first full-time chief of staff, Reince Priebus. Mm-hmm. He's been there, you know, about 10 months now. He got there in January, and, you know, that's about half the time that John Kelly was there as well, his predecessor. He's also come under some criticism from John Kelly, who said that he basically told Trump on the way out the door, if you put a yes man in here, you're going to get impeached because you need someone to control your worst impulses, basically implying that Mulvaney has not been doing that. But, you know, Mulvaney has stuck his head down and continued to do the work. You know, whether or not he enjoys the full confidence of the president is not entirely clear, but he's still there for now.
Yeah.
At least as of 9:40.
Yeah, November 4th.
You had to make sure.
We're taping this. Yeah. You never know. We could always get a tweet. Jamie, some great insight. We appreciate you being up in D.C. Thanks for being on. And, of course, God bless the Nats. God bless the United States of America.
God bless the Nats. Stayed in the fight, baby. Stayed in the fight.
Thanks. It's that time again for some campaign trail news updates. Whipcrack. We're looking at the latest in 2020 related movements affecting South Carolina, state campaign news, and highlights from the state's congressional delegation. And if you're listening to us on Tuesday, happy Pod Day, but also happy Election Day. Be sure to get to the polls if you have a municipal election going on in your area. You can find out on scvotes.org. First up on the trail, on November 4th, Mark Sanford, the Republican presidential candidate and former governor of South Carolina, moved his campaign home base to New Hampshire to help his long-shot presidential campaign. Live free or die, indeed. A poll by the Club for Growth's Political Action Group found that 57% of likely Republican voters in the 1st Congressional District were undecided on who to support in the 4-person Republican primary race. State Representative Nancy Mace received 23% of support, while challengers Mike Covert and Chris Cox received 8%, and Kathy Landing at 5%. This race is still wide open, and who knows who else might jump in. And remember that focus group memo we talked about on how Pete Buttigieg's sexuality is playing among black voters in South Carolina? Well, House Majority Whip Jim Clyburn told CNN's Dana Bash on Sunday that it's no secret that it's an issue for older African Americans, who make up a substantial block of the state's Democratic electorate. Now, Clyburn added that it is a generational issue for the black community, knowing that his grandson is a paid staffer for Buttigieg's campaign doing HBCU outreach. And even Boy George weighed in on this. He tweeted, "It's sad to hear that older black voters in South Carolina have issue with Pete Buttigieg living with his husband." Didn't see that coming. Didn't see that Boy George tweet coming. It's 2020, guys. Campaign trail's wide open. The Post and Courier reports that Amanda Loveday will be one of the three senior advisors for the new Biden super PAC called Unite the Country. By law, super PACs can't coordinate with campaigns, but can raise and spend unlimited amounts of money, allowing donors who already have given the maximum $2,800 contribution to a campaign the opportunity to put more resources behind it. Speaking of Joe Biden, he spoke with PBS's Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour that Father Robert E. Morey of St. Anthony Catholic Church in Florence went to the local paper, The Morning News, about denying Biden communion due to his stance on abortion. That's how that big national story came out, with The Morning News getting that scoop. In our final section, Did You Know?, we focus on one quirky function of the state, politics, or government. It's named after the parliamentary procedure that lawmakers use when speaking to each other. And did you know that South Carolina Public Radio's Russ McKinney is here? He is, ladies and gentlemen. And we also have Jamie Lovegrove with us. Stuck around. He's going to get on this action.
I had to bring it home for the Nats one more time here.
A lot of pressure.
Well, in honor of that and that silly hat that he's wearing, the Nats hat that he's wearing, question is, when was the last year that two National League teams played one another in the World Series?
When was that a thing that happened?
Yeah, the answer is 2019. The Houston Astros and the Washington National League team playing for the World. So there will be an asterisk beside the Washington Nationals World Series championship.
You know, people writing letters now.
The Astros.
You do realize, as a lifelong New York Yankee American League fan, we consider the Atlanta Braves an expansion team.
Oh, right, of course.
What's your real question, Ross? Damn it.
Okay, real question. A lot of attention warranted to the African American Museum that's being developed in downtown Charleston. Mm-hmm. The significance of African Americans in the history of South Carolina is really incredible if you really, really take a look at it. It's estimated that almost half of the African slaves brought into this country came in via Charleston. But did you know that, much like Ellis Island, which is a quarantine facility in New York where so many European immigrants came in, Charleston also had a quarantine station. Almost all of the African slaves coming into Charleston went to this station before they actually went to the market in downtown Charleston. Hmm. So our question is, where is South Carolina's Ellis Island?
Interesting question, Russ.
Yeah. Right, so your choices are A, James Island, B, Morris Island, C, Sullivan's Island, D, Daniel's Island.
Yeah. just trying to think in relation to the wharf, you know, and how...
That's an interesting way of thinking about it.
James Island, Morris Island, Sullivan's Island, Daniel Island.
Well, I feel like Sullivan's is, like, you know, actually out there too, you know, and it's trace your way in. But... there's no roads connecting Sullivan's Island. I mean, like, I guess they would just take boats back over, back and forth, but what do you think, Jamie? What are you thinking?
That's interesting. I was probably leaning towards Sullivan's as well.
Yeah.
I'm amazed that I haven't seen, I'm sure there's some markers somewhere. I'm amazed I haven't seen any kind of markers around down there. Interesting.
Well, there is a marker, and it is at Sullivan's Island.
Oh, there it is.
It's estimated that more than half of all African Americans in this country have ancestors who came in through the quarantine station at Sullivan's Island.
And you said there is a marker down there we can go look for?
And you will have to look for it.
Okay, that's why it's hidden somewhere down there.
Well, there are actually a couple there. The Nobel laureate Toni Morrison, of her own volition, some years ago, I think it was back in the 1990s, raised funds for a bench, I think, that recognizes that. Wow. And then sometime about 10 years ago, the National Park Service at Fort Moultrie put up a plaque that recognized the significance of the Sullivan's Island quarantine station.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we're going to be learning about a lot more about that history, obviously, once that museum does open. They just broke ground on it, so it should be interesting and definitely educational. Thanks for us. That was very interesting.
Thanks for us. Go Nats.
See, you brought it home again there, James. I was like, ooh. The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to help keep you informed. Check out the latest news and live streams on scetv.org. Listen to coverage from South Carolina Public Radio and watch This Week in South Carolina, a show where I talk with the newsmakers of the week on SCETV, Friday at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday at 11:30 a.m. All of that, this podcast, and more is available on SCETV's super easy-to-use app and southcarolinapublicradio.org. Subscribe to us, and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts. Search us easily on your Android app, the NPR One app, or wherever you find podcasts, like Spotify. Also, be sure to rate and review us on iTunes. We'll give you a shout-out, I promise. Follow us on Instagram at SCLeadPod, and you can see photos from the studio, on assignment, and of course, our dank, dank memes. We're also on Twitter with the same handle, at SCLEDEPOD. And we have swag, sticker swag, that is. Send us a direct message on Twitter or Instagram with your name and address, and we'll send one your way. Email questions, comments, or your gripes to scled@scetv.org. South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Post and Courier. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our supervising producer. Tom Posey is our executive producer. This episode was recorded and produced in South Carolina Public Radio studios here in Columbia on November 4th, 2019. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening. Secret message. Limit your technology use after 6 p.m. and eat your sleep bugs. #circadianrhythm.